This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You know, I mean, I'm only like 4 years older than him, so
old for football, but he is still in the prime of his life.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at excellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Matt Ryan of Education Reform, Brandon Wright.
All right.
And also, Alyssa Schwenk.
Who's that, Ryan?
That's why I had Brandon be the official co-host this week, is because I spent a lot of time on Sunday watching football. And Matt Ryan is incredible quarterback for the Atlanta Falcons.
Oh, I don't like that.
Call her Julio Jones.
Julio Jones was incredible as well.
I was rooting for the Steelers and the Packers in a very hands-off sense. So I don't like the Super Bowl.
No, I know. I was rooting for the Packers as well. I just think you always got to root for, you know, you always got to root for the city that is in the sort of tougher financial economic shape, right?
It's also so Green Bay.
You got to root for the industrial heartland.
But like, it's Green Bay too. Like, they still own the team and it's like this tiny little town.
Yes.
And I also always like to see the Wolverine quarterback win.
Yes.
Mr. Tom Brady.
Okay. But you're not going to root for Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, are you? Brandon, it's like the Yankees. You have to root against the Patriots. It's a rule.
My wife is from the Atlanta area, and she's not a big fan.
So. Well, that's because they usually suck, but this year they're really good. And did you know how many championships Atlanta teams have ever won?
No, I don't.
More than Cleveland teams?
One.
One.
Ooh, okay. Ooh,
isn't that crazy? Once, the Atlanta Braves.
All right,
once.
Fair enough.
So they deserve it. Yeah, they're the Cleveland of this year's
football.
Football.
Okay. All right.
All right. And Alyssa's upset that we didn't talk about Oscars. That's only because with two small children, I have seen probably none of the Oscar nominations.
You should go to Hidden Figures. The boys would love Hidden Figures.
You should see Hidden Figures. I will have to check what got nominated for the animation.
Moana.
Zootopia.
Yes, also a good
How
movie.
How about the one with the two strings? Kobu and the two strings? No, that was an incredible movie that totally deserves to win.
I've literally never heard of that movie.
This is probably a problem. This might explain why it may not have gotten nominated. All right, I'll have to check that out. Let us know, readers, what you think and if there's any other movies that I should see on a rare date night. But we're not here just talking about sports and pop culture. There have been some things happening in this town. If you haven't noticed, a few things here in Washington the last few days.
It's been a little busy.
It has been a little busy. Let's talk about it in Ed Reform Update. Okay, so President Trump. There, I said it. I said it. President Trump in his inaugural address, of which I was not a big fan, let it be known. I think like most, you know, conservative think tanky people, not super thrilled with its dark tones and protectionist arguments. But he did say a little bit about education. He said that our schools are flush with cash and that they deprive students of, quote, all knowledge. Now, let's talk about this. On the one hand, I forget Rick Hess's statement when he wrote about this week, but certainly acknowledged that this was not useful language, way over the top. On the other hand, Jay Green was quoted in one of the papers saying, look, it's a little hyperbole, but, you know, it's not so out of the mainstream to say that our schools have plenty of money and to say that they're not getting good results.
Surprisingly, Libby Nelson at Vox actually said the same thing, saying he wasn't all that far off. And obviously, Vox is not a fan of Trump.
So let's start with the flush with cash statement. What is that fair? I mean, if you had to say, like, how many schools out there are flush with cash, what would you say?
I would say it depends on, I would say the answer depends on who you ask. Like, while I was watching the inaugural address, and he said this, like, three people I was watching with turned to me, and they're like, is that true? And I'm like, it depends. I think some schools have a decent cushion of funding. Certainly, we do have some very well-funded or private schools, universities of higher education, even some suburban schools that have really strong local property tax bases have money. Whether or not they're using it properly is another question.
I don't know. What do you think, Brandon? I mean, I kind of think it's probably like a bell curve, right? There are a handful of these high-end suburban schools that spend a ridiculous amount of money. There are a handful of urban school districts. New Jersey districts come to mind. Mm-hmm. District of Columbia comes to mind. That are also spending astronomical amounts on education.
Yeah, the hard thing about evaluating
but there's
a statement
on the other end, right?
Like that is that when it comes to schools, because education is so locally and state based, It's all over the place, which goes to the bell curve thing. When you take it sort of internationally and look at the statement comparatively, I believe that only 3 developed countries spend more on elementary school kids and just 5 do on high school kids. Yeah. But again, we are such heterogeneous country that it's hard to evaluate the statement. Surely there are tons of schools that are not flush with cash.
Yeah.
Some that are.
So, and it's interesting, you know, the schools that are probably least likely to be flush with cash are those that serve Trump's base.
Yeah.
You know, sort of middle class, working class families, that those are going to be the places that probably don't have a ton of money, because it's either the elite people, the schools that serve the elites that have a ton of money in affluent suburbs, and then the schools that serve the very poorest kids in some areas where people, I know, not everywhere, but in some areas, especially on the East Coast, where there's been a success in getting lots more money for those schools. And it's the ones in between where actually, if you go out to you know, places in the heartland, you say, yeah, these schools, they sure don't feel flush with cash.
Yeah, and I think if you asked a teacher out in the heartland if they were flush with cash,
of course,
they would start laughing.
Yeah, but come on, listen. I mean,
just say it.
I, and again, not to denigrate the teacher. It's just that, of course, a teacher is going to feel like they could always have more money in their school, or, you know, would certainly feel, and in many cases rightfully, that they're not making as much money as they wish that they could.
Mm-hmm.
But there's got to be a more objective way to look at it.
Right.
Which is also hard, because what does flush with cash actually mean?
Yeah.
Clearly, often Trump is hyperbolic.
Yeah.
So if he's saying that...
Or just alternative facts.
Alternative facts.
Which is beyond all hyperbole. Okay, go ahead.
So if he means that just schools have enough cash, in a lot of cases, he's probably right.
Yeah.
Flush.
Right. Flush is a different word. All right, let's talk about depriving children of all knowledge.
Like, that's the part where I was just like, well, now this is...
Yeah.
This is Blake.
Now, the word got added in by him. That was interesting. It was not in the text. So it was going to be deprived of knowledge. Now, we've certainly argued that our schools are not focused enough on knowledge. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was interesting. The word knowledge wasn't skills. It wasn't that they're not helping kids be successful. I mean, you could say all those, but he's focused on the word knowledge.
Core knowledge campaign.
Exactly.
I don't know if I would necessarily take his use of the word knowledge to mean specifically the way that we at Fordham have interpreted knowledge, which means, you know, a hearty dose of civic education, et cetera.
History, science, art, music.
But
knowledge. You just don't want to be associated with them, Alyssa.
If you take it more broadly, though,
and just talk about performance, then clearly the United States on big international tests just doesn't do well, except for especially young kids. For like 4th graders, the U.S. does pretty good. But as you get older, the U.S. does not do well. So... obviously, it's not all knowledge or like all skills.
Right. Or
he's the most intelligent. So.
But again, if the point is that...
He's like, you know, a really smart person.
Yes, he went to the same college
I'm just quoting him from his CIA verbatim, several
addresses.
If you combine these two things, poor international test scores with the fact that very few developed countries spend more on education than the United States, then basically, although it's hyperbolic, if you take away the hyperbole, what he's saying isn't untrue.
All right, now what about his argument... that was really the heart of the address, that it was elites, and especially elites in Washington, that are to blame for all these jobs going overseas, that we elites made a decision in recent decades to allow free trade to happen, which shifted wealth from the American middle class, from the American heartland, to other countries, to China, etc. This argument is obviously powerful, popular. Is he right? Because those of us in education reform have tended to say that we kind of take free trade as a given.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore what we need to do is to better educate our populace in order to compete, in order to justify higher wages because our people have more skills.
It's hard to answer because I'm not really an economist. And clearly this is a very complicated question. Like, to what extent does free trade play a role? To what extent does comparative advantage, to what extent does currency manipulation? I read a very long article before I came into this room, and it was very complicated.
Brandon. He's wrong.
Which is what the article concluded.
Could have led with that. No, I think, and again, I think I'm even less of an economist than Brandon here is. So full disclosure there. Yeah. But my concern and the argument that we've long advanced in ed reform is that it's increasing technological innovation that has had kind of the worst impact on the middle class jobs and those factory jobs, et cetera, less the free trade side of things.
I mean, look, I don't want to be a churlish here or insensitive to the fact that there have been huge disruptions. And I think now economists are admitting that the disruption from China entering the world economy was much bigger and broader than they expected it to be. And for older workers who are displaced and, you know, difficult to retrain, I totally understand that they got a raw deal. However, you know, as far back as the 80s, people like Lamar Alexander and Bill Clinton and other Dick Riley, other Southern governors especially, were saying, hey, there's a new economy coming. And if our people aren't going to be left behind, we need to do a much better job educating people, because we are not going to be, there's going to be no more such thing as a low skill, high wage job. Mm-hmm. And if we want to keep wages high, we're going to have to justify it by having higher skills. And we did not get the job done.
Well,
and I think that is why there's so much pain out there. Now, again, I'm not per se blaming our schools. We also blame our policies. You know, if we'd started some of these reforms a decade or two earlier, maybe we would have, gotten there or helped more people. But, you know, to just throw up our hands and somehow have this fantasy that, you know, we're just going to stop free trade, or we're going to go back to the day when somebody can make a high wage at a factory, you know, again, the automation, that's just not going to happen.
Well, so true. The long-term fix, as it has been for a long time, is to train American adults to thrive in this sort of new economy, this high-skilled or at the very least high-capital economy. But the problem is, obviously, that's a long-term goal. Currently, there are tons of adults, and there will be over the next 4 years when Trump is in office, who aren't going to be trained. So then the question comes down to, perhaps, over the next 4 years, do you do anything to, in the short term, lessen the negative impact?
Yeah.
So if one of those policies is to sort of protect American low-skill employees by stopping jobs from going...
I think that's going to hurt more than help. But you're right. We're not economists here. You know, infrastructure spending on certain ways, I feel more supportive of than the protectionism. Finally, because we're running out of time, let me ask this. We got a taste of what it's going to be like to be an education reformer in the Trump era. Are we feeling more optimistic, less optimistic than a week ago? Alyssa, how are we going to get through this?
I think we're going to hopefully get through it by sticking together. But what we've seen in the last 2 weeks between the confirmation hearings, which are quite at this point brutal, and with that kind of tenor that was set during this address, it's going to be, I predict, some rough sailing ahead.
I think there's a lot of drama and sort of to do about stuff that really isn't all that important, like the confirmation hearings. Almost everyone has always gotten confirmed, always. I think it'll be fine.
All right. We keep hoping to turn the page. Hey, maybe February, we'll get past this. We'll get back to work. All right. That's all the time we got for Ed Reform Update. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike.
Hey, did you watch football over the weekend?
I did. Wow. Poor Aaron Rodgers, right? That was sad.
He got crushed. But Matt Ryan, this guy is so good.
I know. He's good. But I mean, I just couldn't believe how bad they got whipped up on, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, wow. And I just love Aaron Rodgers. I mean, you know, I love the Skins, but the Skins never win. So I got to go to Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just sad.
Yes. Well, you know.
But, you know, I'm not a Steelers fan, so didn't care so much that they lost.
But you're rooting for the Atlanta now, right?
I think I am, you know. I think I am, Mike.
Come on. Why is this a tough decision? It's like the Yankees. You root against the Patriots.
I know. I mean, I know. Right? And he knew that football was deflated,
Of course. He's a cheater. They're cheaters.
Of course he knew.
They're probably still cheating today.
But
who knows what they're up to.
Look at him, Alyssa, he's easy on the eyes.
He is very easy on the eyes.
I can't help it. You look at him, you're like, oh.
Hey, I don't mind this because it gives us older guys some hope, you know? I mean, I'm only like 4 years older than him. So
he's old for football, but he is still, I think, in the prime of his life.
He's married to a supermodel for a good reason.
Yeah.
So.
Fine. All right, what you got for us?
We got a new study out of AEFP Journal that examines how different grading systems impact student effort. So it examines how student effort changes when the grading system goes from an absolute system where standards are fixed. This is what we're used to, right? Like you meet the standard, you get an A through a D,
right,
and you pass. If you get an F, you don't. And a relative system where the standards depend on the performance of the class.
Forced curve.
And the number who passed is fixed, also known as grading on a curve.
Is this now in higher ed or high school?
This is in higher ed. This is what I was going to say. I just thought this was a cool study because we just don't, I have never read one of these studies before in the U.S. context. So it's an international study. It's on higher ed, but who cares? It's a cool study. And it was an AFPF journal. So obviously a lot of other people thought it was cool too.
Mm-hmm.
They used data from the University of Chile where the grading system changed from absolute to relative. Hmm. And they were able to compare the grade distribution before and after the change to identify impacts of the new system. They used 20 consecutive years of data from students who were enrolled in economics and business classes at the university. Before 1998, the grades in these classes were absolute. Beginning in 1998, they changed to relative. And in 2003, they changed back to absolute. Okay.
Huh.
So researchers love that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay. So the changes were promoted by the administration. They were implemented for all sections at the same time. Other courses were not affected. So all the stars sort of align for a nice study design. They used the grade distribution before and after the time of the change to identify the causal impact of relative grading. They did all these tests to show that the comparison group that they were using sort of before and after the change was actually a comparable and valid control group. And they go through a bunch of reasons why that's so. Okay, so I won't get into that.
This is like a researcher heaven study.
You know. effort is measured indirectly through grades and ability is measured via college entrance exam. Similar to the SAT. Okay. The key finding, I'm there finally. Low ability students, those with who scored low on the college entrance exam, have higher grades, aka exert more effort, when the grading system is relative.
Mm-hmm.
The effect dissipates as ability level increases. For example, a student with entry score at the 10th percentile would significantly increase his grade by roughly 0.15 standard deviations when the grading system changes from absolute to relative. Okay. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, high ability students reduce their effort when the grading system changes from absolute to relative, but it's not as strong of an impact for them. So in other words, a student with an entry score at the 99th percentile would decrease his grade by about 0.22 standard deviations when with the change in the grading system. The conclusion, they go through this big thing of their trade-offs, right, relative to students who are, you know, based on their ability level.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that, you know what, it provides incentives for low ability students who might otherwise give up if they're grading on the curve. But it is tends to be, you know, a little bit different story for the higher performing students. And they give an example of maybe in higher ed, if you're looking to, if you're going to like have a ton of a huge cohort in a higher ed class and you need to, you know, kind of get rid of some of the kids that, you know, you might want to look at the absolute grading. Mm-hmm. And if you're...
As long as you have a real standard.
As long as you have a real standard.
Right.
Right. I mean, I think at K-12, we think of it as sort of pitting kids against each other, right? And it's rare. But this is interesting in that, you know, we do see that in this case, it could have some appeal for the low performing kids.
So curves work better for a low performing
student. That's right.
That is the exact opposite of what I would have expected.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Why so?
As a very conscientious student, had I known that there was a curve in a class instead of just straight out, I would have been more concerned about other people getting a higher grade than me and my effort, you know, leading to a lower grade that I would have put an extra effort to ensure that I got a good grade.
I see.
I was a nerd though.
Right. And it does make my head hurt a little bit to try to figure out if grade is a good indication of effort or not.
Right.
Since we don't have another measure of how they actually performed in the class.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, but it's you know kind what? Of I like the topic of grading and grade inflation. We should do something on that, Amber.
We just might be doing something on that. Yes. We just got to get it funded.
Okay. Yes. An important issue. All right.
Yes.
Cool. Hey, thanks for taking us on our trip to Chile.
I know.
I hope some people got to go to Chile and enjoy their beautiful country and great wine as a part of this experience. That'd be a bonus. All right, that is all the time we've got for the Education Gadfly Show. Until next week,
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.